So good morning. Today, the weather is very bad, and we are very sparse, which maybe does me a little bit of good for this reason alone, that I miscounted my Sundays and how I was lining up all of my presentations, and this week is the one week where basically, I don't have anything to say. Everything is set up for next Sunday because next Sunday is Cheese Fair, and I want to talk about the Prayer of St. Ephrem. I want to talk about Forgiveness Vespers. I want to talk about the Great Canon of St. Andrew and the Presanctified right there the day that we begin all those things so that it'll be fresh in our minds and all. I have a little gap here today, and I put together one lesson that I thought would be decent, and the more I got into it, the more I realized this is going to open up a huge can of worms, and I really don't care to open a can of worms, and I just don't want to deal with that at all. So, like many great ideas, this one was born in the shower out of desperation. But I will tell you, I think you will find this interesting nevertheless, because it concerns the highlight of my week this week, which was to be able to do a telephone or a Skype interview with the librarian of the Monastery of St. Catherine on Mount Sinai. And for me, this is like a big feather in my hat. The Monastery of St. Catherine has been there since at least the 4th century. We know from the writings of the famous Spanish pilgrim Egeria, she's a Spanish noblewoman, who traveled from Spain throughout the ancient world to the holy places in the Middle East. And her accounts of the services and the ceremonies and the description of the churches and the holy places in Jerusalem is the best description that we have from the 4th century about what went on. And she also documented that she went to Mount Sinai, and she was at the monastery there, that there were monks there, and she climbed to the top of Mount Sinai where Moses saw the burning bush and received the tablets of the law. And she also was in the cave that Elijah the prophet went into when he went to sleep after he had traveled 40 days to Sinai when Jezebel was after him. And while she was in the cave of prophet Elijah, she read the scriptural accounts of his travel there and his stay there. And she got the books from the monks who were there. So we know there was already a library, or at least a small collection of books for the monks that were living there already in the 4th century. So we're talking early 300s here. Okay. The monastery eventually was, they believe, partially endowed in the days of Constantine the Great. Emperor Constantine the Great at one point commissioned 50 entire Bibles to be written and given to major Christian centers. Please remember that in those days, books were handwritten on parchment, and to produce something as large as an entire Bible was really a princely undertaking. Very, very few people had money to commission such a work, and to commission 50 was just an astronomical sum of money. So Constantine did this, and there is some reason to believe that the very famous Codex Sinaiticus, which is the oldest existing single-bound version of the Bible that we have, which is there at Sinai, may have been one of the ones that Emperor Constantine gave to the monastery in his day. Okay? And the Codex Sinaiticus is very famous. It's in the British Museum right now. But there's hope that they will be getting it back to Sinai once the whole thing has been completely digitized, if it hasn't already, so that scholars have access to it. So the monastery was further endowed, again, in the days of Emperor Justinian in the 6th century. Okay, they had been subject to some marauding bands. I mean, they're right on the Bedouin route. The travel route. So the Bedouins go by there, the migratory pattern takes them right by St. Catherine's Monastery. And I guess they'd been subject to some raids. And so the Emperor Justinian built granite walls around the monastery and a basilica church. And a basilica church is a long rectangular church. It's not a square one like what we have with a dome in the center. It's a long church and a bell tower. The walls of Justinian's walls survived to this day. So if you ever see pictures of the St. Catherine's Monastery, the walls are like 20 or 30 feet high. And they are Justinian's walls. And the basilica church is still standing in the center of the monastery. He also sent vestments, icons, chalices, books, and everything else for the use in the church there. And some of the very famous icons that we have, some of you may remember the so-called Christ of Sinai. It's a very famous icon. Ancient Faith bookstore reproduces that very often, and a lot of converts find this icon of the Christ of Sinai. It's very famous because it's one of the few icons that we have that comes from the period before iconoclasm, because iconoclasm was rather thorough in destroying a lot of icons at the time. And because the Sinai Peninsula was not in Byzantine imperial territory, in Byzantine law and iconoclasm was not able to reach them, and so their icons survived. So some of the oldest icons that we have are also at Sinai, which is preserved also because the climate there is very dry and things tend not to mold, right? Tradition has it also that Muhammad himself, the false prophet of Islam, to get in my dig, was a Bedouin and used to travel that migration route and used to go by St. Catherine's Monastery when he traveled. And there is, I understand that there is an inscription that is mounted inside the monastery there that they have that is traditionally in Muhammad's own handwriting, that this monastery, because it had given him hospitality, was never to be molested or disturbed. And St. Catherine's, even though it has been completely surrounded by in Muslim territory since the 7th century, has never been overrun. The monks have never been slaughtered. It has always been continuously occupied since the 3rd century. And for the sake of the Bedouins who travel by there and who trade with the monastery, there's a little store there. They pick up necessary supplies. There's also a mosque inside the walls of Justinian. So whenever any of the Bedouins are traveling by, they have a place for them to worship, and the Christians worship in the church as well. So, you know, that's how they get on, and they've been getting on that way ever since. So the monastery has been there for all of this time. And some of the things that they have discovered, well, first off, because the climate is so dry, it's rather like Egypt. And so all of the books and the manuscripts that they have there are in a very good state of preservation, better than in a lot of other places. And they have thousands of handwritten manuscripts and parchments and papyrus and everything else that they have there. Some of them falling apart at this time, but others in fairly good shape. And scholars have always known this. So the cataloging the works at Sinai has always been a nice scholarly undertaking. There is something else, though, that's recently gotten international attention, and it was even written out in the recent version of the Smithsonian Magazine. And that is that it has to do with the way that books were manufactured and the fact that they were rare. As I said, before the invention of paper, all books were written on animal skin. Okay? Now, I know in Russia they wrote on birch bark, or you had papyrus, you know, but by and large it was written on animal skin, either goat skin, which is vellum, or sheep skin, or cow skin, which gives you parchment. And when books are so valuable, in the first place, it points out to the fact of international trade, because there are no cows at Sinai, and very few goats, you know. And in order to produce parchment and vellum in large quantities, this was always an urban enterprise, because you had the parchment makers were right next to the slaughterhouses, and you had to have large operations to get enough skin, you know, and to process all this stuff in quantity to make it all work. So simply getting parchment at Sinai was an undertaking. But since it was valuable and expensive, what they would do, if you had already written on something and you needed to reuse it, you could. And so you would take a pumice stone or something else rough, and you would simply rub all of the writing off of the parchment. You could then smooth it again and write over it. And this is what people did for a long time. When you have a parchment that has something that's been erased, and has been written over a second time is called a palimpsest. And sometimes the erasure is not real good, and you can still tell what was there before that had been erased. And, you know, we can do that with our own handwriting now. You know, you erase something, there's a residue, you can hold something up to the light, or you could turn it at an angle, you can see the imprint, you know, of the pencil, even if the marks aren't there. So there are ways of reading what used to be there and has since been erased. And scholars have always been very interested in palimpsests, because there's a whole other text that's underneath there. Think of it too. If you had something that was going to be erased and reused, it's not going to be the newest stuff you've got. It's not going to be the most useful books that you have. It's going to be the old stuff, the oldest things that are falling apart, or maybe pages are missing, or the binding has come loose, or rats chewed the first third of the book, or something like that. So it's usually the oldest stuff that you have that gets recycled and, you know, erased and written over. So some of the oldest manuscripts they have found are in fact palimpsests. And what's become more exciting is that not only have scholars are able to see, oh yeah, this used to have something written on it before, but using some very sophisticated imaging techniques nowadays, that is, of setting these books up and photographing them in ultraviolet light, in infrared light, and in all sorts of other wavelengths and all, they're able to see what had been written there previously, because some of the inks and the dyes and the minerals and the inks show up better in different kinds of light. And so they've been photographing some of these really old books in like 8 or 10 different kinds of light and all, and then using computers to superimpose the images until they get the best look of what was underneath the text. And they have discovered wonders and treasures. They have discovered about 280 palimpsests, which they did not know they had. And they have discovered things that they did not know existed. They have discovered classical Greek pagan poetry. They have discovered a medical text or two. Hippocrates. I think Galen had, it was Galen who had a book, it was an herbal, so that you know what medicinal herbs were for, and actually had illustrations of the leaves so you would know what the plants look like so you can go out and find them. They actually found a page that had a drawing of a leaf on it with the description of the plant. They found a second century Syriac translation of the Gospels, which is the oldest Syriac rendition of the Gospels that we have. The earliest one we had previously was 5th century, so there's a 300-year gap. But even more significantly, apparently, the written record for the transmission of the Gospels, we have some stuff from the 1st century, we have lots of stuff from the 3rd century, but we have very little from the 2nd century, almost nothing. And now we have literary evidence about the transmission of the Gospel there in the 2nd century. So scholars have been all over this stuff, and they're continuing to discover new stuff all the time. And this, as I say, has gotten some international recognition, because now all of these things are being photographed in all these ways and are being made available to scholars. So a fellow Texan, about 40 years ago, he was from El Paso, went to University of Texas at Austin and studied history. And he fell in love with Byzantine history. And having fallen in love with Byzantine history, he subsequently fell in love with the Orthodox Church and converted and became Orthodox and became a monk. And he was a monk, Father Justin, in an American monastery for about 20 years. And during that time, he made two pilgrimages to Mount Sinai, to St. Catherine's Monastery that's there. And he fell in love with that place as well, because he loves history. And I mean, a place that is as drenched in history as Mount Sinai and St. Catherine's, he just loved it. And finally, he was given a blessing to go and become a monk there. So he decamped from America and went to Sinai and has been a monk there for about 15 years. And because he loved the manuscripts and the history so much, 10 years ago, they made him the librarian, which is very special there, because only the librarian, he's the only one who is allowed access to the archives. He is the only one who is allowed access to any of the books or manuscripts there. If you're a scholar and you want to go study something, I know how it works. It's like in the Vatican Library where I've been. You submit your request to the librarian for the book or manuscript you want. You sit there for an hour until somebody goes and finds it in the archives and brings it back to you, and you get to sit there at a table without photographic equipment, and in old things you put on little cotton gloves so that you don't actually touch and you degrade the manuscript anymore, and they watch you while you read it and study it, and you can have pencil and paper with you, and that's about it. And then when you're done, you give it back, and they make sure that it's intact, that you haven't put, you know, leaves or pages in your pocket or something, you know, and all, because that happens, regrettably, it happens. So at any rate, Father Justin is now over there at Mount Sinai, and he went there to save his soul and to live in a remote, out-of-the-way corner of the world, and because of the Sinai Palimpsest Project, he's now host to international groups of scholars who are there photographing his library for extended periods, and he is now required to go and travel and to explain what he's doing and to give papers at academic conferences on the work that is being done. So his desire to be a historian, you know, sort of like the grain of wheat, fell to the ground and died for a while, but in his old age has blossomed to new life. And as a result of this project, someone at the Door Radio Orthodox Radio program decided that he would be a fun one to interview, especially since he was an American and spoke English. And so they arranged for an interview, and I was called to do the interview. So I got to talk with Father Justin for about an hour last Thursday. It's 7 hours in advance over there, so it was after Vespers when I talked to him, but it was noon here. And we talked all about the project and all, and it was a lot of fun. And he's a fascinating guy who knows his history really well. And the talk will be is being edited down now and should, I think it's due to be broadcast next Sunday afternoon. What's that, 4:30 I think is the time when the Door Radio program comes up, 4:30, something like that. And you can hear it. If you don't hear it on the radio, they always post it online a couple of days afterwards. So when we get a link to it, I will let you know so you can hear about this, because this is just whiz-bang good stuff. And they continue to make discoveries there, and Father Justin was open to talking to us again. So God willing, you know, after Pascha, we'll see if we can't get back with him and find other topics to talk with this guy about. So that was the highlight of my week. Thoughts or observations or comments on Palimpsest? And I have the Smithsonian article here. You can look at it. But I mean, they have just this one particular big colorful page. I know you can't really see what it is. But this is the medical text with the picture of the leaf on it, so that you could see what the plant looked like that you were looking for medical purposes. The text is in Greek, but it is underneath the oldest Arabic translation of the Gospels that we have. So no one's going to undo the oldest Arabic translation, see what's underneath it, because it's valuable in itself. But here's something also valuable underneath. And they have been able to tease out all of the color and everything. So the Arabic is this way. The Greek text is this way. But you can see this up here. It's just fascinating stuff to look at. Yeah, here. Yes, there is a Texan who's librarian at St. Catherine's on Sinai. We get around. Who'd have thunk? Yeah. Every so often you run into them. I had hoped to meet a Texas monk on Mount Athos when I was on Mount Athos in 2009. He was at the next monastery down. I was told they found out I was Texan. Oh, you need to meet Father so-and-so, but he's, you know, the next monastery down. And I went down there to meet him, but he wasn't in. He had some obedience way out in the fields behind the monastery and all. And they said you could always tell when he was coming because he rode this four-wheeled all-terrain vehicle, and he drove really fast. So the Texan, you could always tell by the cloud of dust on the horizon as it went. The front of it would be the mad Texan. So, yeah, we get around. And, you know, it's kind of a testimony also to the fact that, you know, the monastery library there has manuscripts from every century, and they have manuscripts in 11 different languages. And so even though it's like really remote and travel was really difficult, nevertheless, there was commerce, there was travel, there was academic and scholarly work going on, the exchange of manuscripts, people were studying and reading and all kinds of stuff in those days.
In fact, I think one of the most interesting things Father Justin told me was that they had one piece of parchment that had actually been stitched together out of a bunch of smaller pieces. Okay, so they needed a big page. All right. They found that one of the little pieces that had been stitched into this was palimpsest. And the writing behind it, the original writing, was in Latin. And not only was it in Latin, it was in a particular half-uncial script that was only used in Ireland and Great Britain in the 6th and 7th centuries. Now, how did that get there? How did you get manuscripts from Ireland or Great Britain to Mount Sinai? Or was there an Irish monk who somehow made his way there and, you know, that's all that we have left of anything that he wrote? No? If it was an Irish manuscript, this will blow your mind. It was probably Vikings and Varangians who transported it, because they traveled in the northern Atlantic. Okay? And so it probably went from Ireland to Great Britain, through Scandinavia into northern Russia, from Russia down the Volga to the Black Sea, and from the Black Sea into Byzantine territory, and made its way down then through the Black Sea into the Mediterranean, eastern Mediterranean, into the Levant, and finally to Sinai. It probably came that way, because there's increasing evidence of trade going on through northern Russia, between northern Europe and the British Isles, went through northern Europe and then came down into the Byzantine Empire. It's fascinating, fascinating stuff. Yeah.
St. Catherine's, it's on the cliff of Mount Sinai, or is it?
It's at the base.
It's at the base.
Yeah. And then you can go up the mountain is right there behind it.
Since there's so many people there, have they been able to actually date that is actually Mount Sinai?
Oh, they know it's Mount Sinai. It's always been Mount Sinai.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, I see that.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's known that, you know, since time immemorial. Or Horeb, also called Mount Horeb.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So they also, apparently in the monastery, they do have the burning bush. So a very large, I think it's very big now, but
yes.
That's... and somewhere I have leaves from the burning bush. So, for what it's worth. Father Justin did tell me that it's something I didn't know, that cactus are indigenous to the New World, that there are no cactus in the deserts of Europe or Africa. You only get them here. And since he was from San Antonio, or from El Paso, he said that was one thing. He found some cactus at some shop somewhere, and he bought it so he would have at least one to remind him of home. Yeah, yeah, John.
The Vikings is pretty fascinating. So, is it known how old or Horsemen mythology is? Like, what the because there are elements in Norse mythology that I find to be somewhat reflective of Christian theology. Like,
oh, okay.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering if, well, maybe she borrowed it from the Middle East.
I don't know. I don't know that much about my Norse mythology. You know, I did a little bit of work on Yggdrasil, the world tree, only because that's a common archetypal image that even turns up in Prophet Jeremiah. So even in Jewish thought, there's a world tree, which of course we have in the Cross of Christ. It's the Christian version of it. Yeah. The questions I asked Father Justin during the interview were very basic ones. It's sort of a summary of what I've talked about already here this morning, to talk about you know, St. Catherine's, why is the library important? You know, what are some of the most significant books that they have there? Talk about the new Palimpsest project. And, you know, if people want to find out more about it, where can they go to find it? Yeah, we talked a bit personally before and afterwards. You know, just to get a sense of who each other are and, you know, how we interact so we'd know how the conversation would go once we got to recording it. Yeah, very personable man. Yeah. Light sense of humor. You know, monks aren't always the jolliest, you know. Yeah, Harry.
Did you ask him about that letter that's either from Muhammad or one of his?
Oh, no, I we didn't get around to that one. Okay. Yeah.
Some people kind of use it as propaganda to say, oh, the Muslims are very peaceful and loving, but really they slaughtered everybody. You know, Egypt is where monasticism is from. And
oh, yeah.
There used to be a lot of Christian monastic places. Mm-hmm. They were all slaughtered. That one place, whatever.
Yeah. But the devastation of Scetus, as it is called, the slaughter of most of the monastic communities in Egypt was actually in the 5th and 6th centuries. It was the century before Muhammad. It was not an Islamic wave that took out the monasteries. It was pagans that took out that. Now, Muhammad's conquest under Omar, the caliph, yeah, that they slaughtered quite a number of people, Jews and Christians as well. And once they got to Persia, you know, Zoroastrians. But for some reason, St. Catherine's was never molested.
I've never heard that, like he actually traveled there and stayed at that.
I don't know that he stayed there, but he definitely went by there because that is the prehistoric Bedouin, you know, migratory route through there. You know, it's the nomadic route. It goes right by there. You know, so.
And you were saying there's a mosque inside.
There's a mosque inside the monastery. Yeah. Yeah. Well, because that's who the neighbors are. I mean, if you're in a place where there are nomads, I mean, you don't have a settled community there. But when people come through, you need a place for them to worship. This is actually the old Irish model as well, because the Irish people were nomadic, and which is why the Irish monasteries were so important. They were along the migratory routes, and they were great pilgrimage sites. So as the Irish people migrated, they went from monastery to monastery along the way, and that's how they worshipped. Yeah, it wasn't until a little later on that the Irish settled down and became farmers. Yeah, when Patrick got there, they were nomads.
What was the key of words you were saying at the very beginning?
Oh, I ain't even going to go there. No, because you are not opening up a can of worms at the very end. That would be even worse. So that topic is closed, and you will never know what it is. Is it time for the hour?
Yes.
Okay, I've managed to fill my time. All right, I promise next week we will be back. I hope it was worth your time to listen this morning, but next week we will be back on things appropriate to the preparation for Great Lent. And as I say, we'll talk about the Great Canon and the Prayer of St. Ephraim and forgiveness vespers and all those sorts of things. Not only why we do them, but how we do them, so that those of you who are newer to the faith, you know, can participate more fully in them. They'll be more meaningful to you that way. All right? Okay, thanks much.